Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. It's Valentine's Day. What would you do to show your love? We're going to hear from an engineer whose daughter's heart condition prompted him to 3D model the human heart. And as Modernism Week kicks off in Palm Springs, we'll revisit a time when designers and artists were creating a new world.
Maholi was a modernist pioneer who loved every medium known in his time to artists and everybody else in the world. He was a utopian who believed that art, hand in hand with technology, can make the world a better place, and acted on that throughout his career.
But first, let's go shopping in downtown Los Angeles. The old Macy's Plaza is being rebranded as The Block, with an open-air court and restaurants and shops aimed at downtown's new residents. It's across the street from the 7th Street Metro Center train station. And last week, officials from Metro and developer Wayne Ratkovich stood in a pedestrian tunnel that connects The Block directly to the station. They took little wooden mallets and banged away at a wall made of foam blocks until it came tumbling down. That was the symbolic opening of a tunnel that had been sealed up for years. Alan Pullman is founder of Studio 111, that's the architecture firm responsible for a huge makeover of Macy's Plaza.
Well, Macy's Plaza was built in the early 1970s, and it was a big downtown revitalization project that included a 500-room hotel, 200,000 square feet of retail, and a 30-story office tower. But it was built at a time when I think the thinking about cities was somewhat suspect. There was, it used to be called the fortress, and I think legitimately, because it really was a fortress against the city. It tried to keep the city out and create a kind of artificial mall-like environment inside.
And I hope I'm not overstating it, but I do believe that this is a window into the future of Los Angeles.
That's Wayne Ratkovich, developer of many downtown revitalization projects dating back to his purchase of the historic Oviatt building in 1977.
This is the way we're going to connect transportation to the places where we work, where we live, where we shop, where we dine, the hotels that we have, to all the events in the city. And this is a connecting link, and it's the first, I hope, of many.
There's a lot of wall talk right now, a lot of talk of building walls. This is a story of knocking the wall down. Just explain, what was the wall that came down this morning?
Well, there was a knockout panel, a concrete wall that had been constructed when the original station was built. And it's been here since that time. And there was always a hope that there would be an opening here, but the prior property owners didn't want it. We did. So we knocked the damn thing down.
Why did the previous owners have such an aversion to the subway?
I can only guess. There has been fear of Metro and who that will bring into your environment. We looked at it just the opposite. We said this is the opportunity to welcome people into our development.
The Block comprises the Macy's flagship department store, a 33-story office building, the Sheraton Grand Hotel, and, now starting to fill up the courtyard area, shops, restaurants, and even an art house theatre. Alan Pullman's firm actually has offices in The Block, and he says this project marks a shift in how LA is being redesigned.
So a lot of our work was to take this fortress and open it up and invite the city back into it. Open up, take off the roof so it didn't feel like a cave, an internally oriented cave. Open up the walls around it so there's much more accessibility. Take out all the gates. There are no gates, so it's just porous. You could walk in and out. And also connect it to the transit system.
So here we are in 7th and Metro, and basically before you bash through the wall, one could still exit the station and you could go up some steps and walk around a corner and you could cross over the street and be at The Block. What the opening up of the wall has done is kind of shortened that route. It's maybe taken 5 minutes down to 2 minutes or something. Based on what you know of how people sort of use cities, do you think that makes a big difference to people's decision to go over to The Block?
Well, that is an excellent question, and one that we asked ourselves. So we're installing motion sensors in the project to see how people are moving through the project. Now, it's not fully leased out, so that'll evolve. But we're going to be tracking like a social life space study of how people move through the project and how this will change the patterns of movement. And I think the retailers are very, very interested in that metric as well, because they depend on foot traffic and they want to see how people are moving through the project. Anecdotally, I suppose, if you go to any other city with a functioning transportation system like a subway, there's always a variety of retail directly connected to the subway stations, and we expect that to start happening here, and hopefully this is the first of many in the city of Los Angeles.
So in a way, what we're seeing with downtown is kind of a back to the future, because in its early days, downtown didn't have the fortress-like buildings. The fortress-like buildings were a byproduct of post-war suburbanization of LA, which produced fortress-like buildings all over the region. Now we're going back to a more sort of conventional urban form for LA's downtown. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. We're catching up. You know, we had a great downtown. Los Angeles had one of the best, you know, west of the Mississippi downtowns pre-war, and that's where all of the shopping was. And what's interesting is there were so many department stores in downtown. There's only one real department store left, and it's the Macy's that's here. It would be great to see more department stores start to emerge. If people in the future start building department stores, that's another subject about retail that we could talk about.
Would you like to talk about it?
Absolutely, because I think retail is really fundamentally changing, evolving, and it's a fascinating subject, because retail is such a kind of, we live in a consumer society, it's such a fundamental part of how we build cities. One thing is, do we need as much retail as we currently have in terms of just the amount of square footage of retail we have in the city? And I think it's probably we have more than we need. So we'll see transitioning of retail that's on some of our corridors and boulevards transition into housing or other kind of uses. And then there's a consolidation in retail into these sort of, I would call them sort of A centers. You think of the Grove, you know, it's doing great and it's consolidating its market share. But then other centers are struggling right now, especially a center that's anchored by a department store, which isn't doing well. I think what's doing well is food. People still are looking for experience, and we live in that experience economy. So food and restaurant and new ideas about food are emerging. The idea of pop-ups and sort of temporary retail things that are happening that activate space are very interesting. They're happening in the city. So it's really evolving. I think some of the old formulas that we used to think about retail are no longer valid in the city.
Lastly, this generally widely shared desire to get rid of the fortress buildings of the 1970s is coinciding with a new affection, at least within the architecture community, for fortress-like buildings, as in brutalism's making a comeback. Reflective glass buildings are making a comeback. Did you come up against any folks who were sad to see the fortress go?
No, but you know, we have a lot of respect for Charles Luckman, who designed this building. And as architects, we kind of are understanding the heroism of brutalist buildings. We think it's really a legitimate part of our architectural heritage that we should not obliterate. We really respected the architecture. We didn't try to impose a new architecture on the armature. What we tried to do was peel back the surfaces, expose this wonderful concrete structure that was designed, and really kind of affirm the beauty of the original, you know, structural masterpiece in some of the places that Luckman put together. It felt like it was true to his original structure, but it operates in a different way. We didn't try to make it into a Grove-like thematic idea, which is something we could have done, but we rejected that early on. We want to respect and celebrate what was really unique about the project.
That's Alan Pullman. He's founder of Studio 111 and the architect for The Block in downtown Los Angeles. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up, we're going to hear about shows of work by a Bauhaus artist and the gleaming white apartment buildings of Tel Aviv. And an engineer models the human heart out of love for his daughter. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton, and if it's February, it must be time to head to Palm Springs for Modernism Week. Any of you who follow design will know that Modernism Week is an annual, now 10-day celebration of mid-century architecture and style, all centered around immaculately restored desert homes. But the sun-kissed, easy-living modernism of Palm Springs in LA owes a big debt to the Bauhaus. That's the radical German art and design school that spawned artists and thinkers dreaming of a better future through design following the horrors of the First World War. Now, two shows currently on display in Los Angeles explore the impact of the Bauhaus. And Avishai Artsy, DNA's producer, has been looking into them. He joins me in the studio to tell me about it. Hello, Avishai.
Hey, Francis.
Okay, Avishai, tell us about these shows.
The first one is at LACMA, and it's the work of the Bauhaus-era artist Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. The show is called Moholy-Nagy Future Present because he's very much working with an eye to the future. And I'm going to let Carol Alil, the curator of modern art at LACMA, who curated the show, tell us a little bit about Moholy-Nagy and his versatility.
Moholy was a modernist pioneer who loved every medium known in his time to artists and everybody else in the world. He made paintings, he made photographs, he made sculptures, he did exhibition design, he did theater design, he did graphic design, he made films. He was a utopian who believed that art, hand in hand with technology, can make the world a better place, and acted on that throughout his career.
What you see are really different types of work side by side. So you might be looking at a photograph he made, and then there's a film projected on the wall, and then an abstract sculpture, and then pieces of graphic design and some drawings and some collage. So you see some themes that persist throughout his career: interest in light and movement and shadow, and an embrace of technology. In fact, one of the rooms that you'll see was based on designs that he had made in 1930 called the Room of the Present that he had never realized, but some art historians were able to recreate that room. And so you walk in and you'll see displays of modernist objects, these beautiful lamps or their films, or there's this what he called light prop for an electric stage, which is this metal sculpture that rotates around.
That room is like a self-contained piece within this installation that was designed by this firm, Johnston Markley. Johnston Markley, very much continuing the sort of modernist tradition, very inventive firm, currently working on the Drawing Institute building at the Menil Collection in Houston. And Markley, you know, shared with us sort of why modernism and the aesthetic values of the Bauhaus are still so meaningful to so many designers.
Well, I think for us, the Bauhaus and the functionalists, there's a latent contradiction, you know, between what they preach and what they show. You know, in a way, there's the rhetoric is very dogmatic, oftentimes like form follows function, and there's a kind of dictatorial way. But the work that they did was so beautiful at the same time. You know, I think this is an attraction of the work. I mean, it's for us like very evident in the early work of Moholy-Nagy. I think that's somehow this lure of modernism is still very strong for us.
The way the show is laid out is actually pretty interesting. You start in a kind of very dark slate gray room, and then you go in sort of an S shape from room to room through his career. But the designers have also cut this kind of diagonal line that cuts directly from the beginning to the end of the room, so you can actually cut through time and see his work kind of in a quick survey as well.
And they've cut doors through each gallery, and it forms this diagonal, and it's like this very dramatic slash. And you see that dramatic slash sort of appearing in some of his artwork, because he was very interested, in his early days at least, in the Russian constructivists.
Exactly. The Russian constructivists, their ideas came out of the Russian Revolution and were very forward-thinking, very progressive, and he really caught on to these ideas. He was born to a Jewish family in Hungary, later converted to Calvinism, and he attended an art school in Budapest, and then he served in the Austro-Hungarian army during World War I, and that's where he really got into the constructivism and the Dadaism era. So let me go back to Carol Alil, because she has a really interesting breakdown of how serving in the war affected his artistic vision.
He served in the war, was wounded, and then discharged for medical reasons, and only after that became a visual artist. There were sort of two responses artistically to the war, one of which was this sort of return to a classical ideal, or to a purity, a purism, a new classicism. And then there was, of course, the Dada anti-art kind of the opposite response to the war. Moholy was actually interested in both of them if you look at the photo montages, and certainly if you look at the very early paintings in the exhibition, you see how much the work is informed by Dada. But at the same time, he was interested in, started to create pure abstractions, was very much interested in light, which is literally a medium, but also I think a conceptual ideal for him as well, which relates to that those utopian notions.
And after the war in 1919, 1 year after the end of the First World War, we see the founding of the Bauhaus, and Moholy Nagy becomes a very important figure there.
Right. So the Bauhaus, as we had mentioned, is this very influential German school of art and design, founded in 1919 by Walter Gropius. And Moholy Nagy taught at the Weimar campus, later at the Dessau campus after it moved there. After the administrators of the school shut it down in 1933 because of pressure from the Nazis, Moholy Nagy moves to Amsterdam and then London and then finally Chicago in 1937, where he founds the new Bauhaus School that later became the Institute of Design and is still going as part of the Illinois Institute of Technology. So Moholy Nagy was one of the most influential thinkers of the Bauhaus. He inspired a whole generation of both German and American artists to pursue a modernist approach to art.
And that approach to art involved a belief in the convergence of science, technology, and art. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, as you walk through the show, you'll really be struck by his adaptation of new material. So plexiglass, for instance, which was being created for airplane windshields. Carol Aliyah, let's go back to her because she talks about how the political and economic situation, both in Germany and the U.S., played a role in the type of work that he made.
Well, I think it really had to do with materials that were available. We also have a painting in the show that's done on formica, which was originally developed to be used as electrical insulation.
And Moholy Nagy talked about his belief in art's ability to benefit humanity. Do you feel like that sense of optimism will be well received at these times?
I think it will be very well received in these times. I think we really need something to feel optimistic about, and I think this show is proof that, you know, people have lived through really challenging times before and managed to survive and to thrive, and if he could do it, so can we.
It's a very interesting show and beautifully displayed. So that's Moholy Nagy at LACMA. Let's go to this other show, Avishai, which in its own way also brings back that time period.
Yeah, so Tel Aviv earned the nickname the White City because of all the buildings that were built there in the 1930s. Now, remember that Tel Aviv was basically built on sand dunes about a century ago, and these were Jewish pioneers coming mostly from Europe to settle this desert area. It was built just north of the ancient Arab town of Jaffa. And two LA-based photographers, Susan Horowitz and Carol Bishop, have spent several years there, and they just came back with all these photos. And the show is called Tel Aviv, the White City and Beyond. It's now on display through the end of May at the Academy for Jewish Religion in California. I asked Susan and Carol why Bauhaus-style architecture took off in Tel Aviv. And Susan answers first.
At that point, the new in architecture was the Bauhaus. So when they needed to accommodate so many people streaming into Israel, they felt that that would be the newest style and one without reference to older design and other cultures.
The style came from the idea of new, a clean slate. And what was more new than these ideas about buildings?
So these architects were using some of the new materials that were available at the time, like reinforced concrete and exposed steel, to build these gleaming white buildings.
So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about a few buildings or hundreds of buildings?
They approximate about 4,000 Bauhaus-style buildings were built in Tel Aviv in the 30s and 40s. It's the largest collection of Bauhaus buildings in the world, and that's why UNESCO declared Tel Aviv a World Heritage Site in 2003. So it's become a popular place for guided tours, especially for architecture buffs to come see these buildings. Now, Susan Horowitz and Carol Bishop, who are longtime friends and colleagues, they wanted to put the show together because it really does show two different perspectives of the White City. Susan's work is all black and white. Carol's is color. Carol's work tends to really accentuate the blue sky and the green palm trees, and it makes it look very Californian, actually. And then Susan Horowitz's piece tends to be much more stark, so you really see where the white is now gray. It gives you a sense of how old they look in a way.
There are some similarities a little bit between Southern California and Israel in terms of this embrace of modernism.
Yeah. One of the architects that I see having some sort of similarity between the work that we're talking about here in Tel Aviv, but is based here in LA, is Dan Brun. He grew up in Tel Aviv, moved to LA when he was fairly young, and he's now embraced the Bauhaus style architecture that in Tel Aviv is mostly seen in apartment buildings. He's using that style in these kind of large single family homes.
It's also tied to materiality. You know, we're using white stucco, smooth trowel, which is very similar to the look of the plaster that you have in Tel Aviv, of the White City. And, you know, the geometric and simple form follows function.
And I think you could find a lot of architects working in Los Angeles that were just as inspired as Dan Brun by the Bauhaus-style architecture that also inspired a lot of the Israeli architects.
So there's something very utopian-sounding about the White City, but I understand that not everybody agrees with that narrative.
Yeah, there was one book that came out a couple years ago that made a splash in Israel, and it's recently been translated into English. It's called White City, Black City, Architecture and War in Tel Aviv and Jaffa. It's written by an Israeli architect and historian named Sharon Rotbard, and he really tries to dispel the mythology around the White City. He points out that only 4 Bauhaus students ever emigrated to Palestine. Tel Aviv really began as a suburb of Jaffa, but once the population boomed in the 1920s with all the Jewish settlers moving to Palestine, it came to overshadow Jaffa. Tel Aviv annexed Jaffa after the War of Independence in 1948. Many of its residents were pushed out and the neighborhoods were bulldozed. And let me just read to you from something Sharon Rotbard said. He wrote, "Tel Aviv eagerly appropriated the Bauhaus brand name in order to develop the local myth about the rebirth of Bauhaus in Palestine. That while the Bauhaus school emphasized these utopian social ideas, the Bauhaus-style architecture that you'll see in Tel Aviv was used actually to whitewash the history of the way that Palestinians were expelled from Jaffa." Not everybody agrees with this. And Bishop said, you know, that the word colonial, which is a word that Rotbard uses, she says is sort of tricky. I mean, she would really say it is utopian. It was these people coming to a new land and settling there and achieving their dream, which is really to start anew. And that's where the White City comes from.
So interesting. And that show is on at the Academy for Jewish Religion, correct?
Yeah, and their offices are in Koreatown on Wilshire Boulevard. We have more information about it and photos from both shows on our website, kcrw.com/DNA blog.
Well, Avishai Artsy, DNA's producer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Francis.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Francis Anderton. Now, today is the day to celebrate romantic love with heart-shaped everything. But what about the workings of the actual human heart? Stephen Levine is a mechanical engineer at Dassault Systems. That's the company that invented CATIA, the software modeling program used for designing curving metal forms from fighter jets to Frank Gehry's buildings. But he's applied this technology to medicine and to literally 3D modeling the human heart. I met Stephen Levine at last year's South by Southwest, where he talked about the Living Heart Project.
I started this journey, as you might say, 26 years ago when my daughter was born with a rare congenital defect. Her heart is reversed, as she likes to say. The left and right sides are transposed, and people don't really understand how it works. Somehow it works, but not perfectly, and they don't really know how long it will last. And as an engineer, it was always frustrating to me working with doctors who struggled to understand how her unique heart would work. And so I thought, if we can help the engineers around the world build the safest cars and the best planes, why can't we look inside and help doctors do the same thing for people?
So what did you do then?
Well, I quickly learned that heart disease is the number one cause of death. And I noted that there are thousands of researchers and clinicians and people all studying different aspects of the heart, but very few people had ever put it together in a way that it actually makes it into the hands of a clinician. So I said, let's start a project to bring everybody together and see if we could all work on a single model.
Levine assembled a team of 85 organizations, including doctors and other healthcare professionals from across the globe, medical companies, and representatives from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The project has run tens of thousands of different hearts on Intel's supercomputer with the goal of creating a library of virtual hearts that researchers can use whenever they want.
Human body is a fascinating machine, not unlike a plane, which also has tens of thousands of different parts. But we know what those are because we create them. So we're doing the reverse. Instead of building it up from 10,000 different parts, we're reverse engineering it, basically, and then rebuilding it on the computer.
And what did you wind up with? Did you wind up with a virtual reality model or a 3D model? What would people see on the computer?
It's a great question. I had to take our engineering data and turn it into essentially a virtual reality hologram and three-dimensional models that people can interact with, look inside. In fact, I built a 3D cave. You can actually step inside and be inside a beating heart and feel the vibrations and see exactly how it's moving. So doctors can see how things work in three dimensions, where they usually have to look at two-dimensional scans. We've all seen the two-dimensional images we get. And in their minds, they have to try to reconstruct what's happening in 3D. We give them that 3D, and immediately they can diagnose the solution based on what they understand, so they don't have to actually try to do that themselves.
How then does that get applied to heart problems?
Well, that's an amazing outcome of what we've done. Because we've worked with so many different specialists, people are applying it in incredible ways. The most initial areas that we worked on was to try to help people who create new devices, new heart valves, pacemakers, things that help improve heart when it's diseased. So they could test those devices on the computer rather than having to do it in laboratories or in other ways, and to shorten the time it takes to do clinical trials and things like that, testing in bodies. But now people are applying it. Surgeons are using it for planning surgeries before, so that they can try the experiments and practice and predict the outcome.
Have you mapped your daughter's heart?
So we're in the process of working on a heart similar to her. One of the challenges and part of what stimulated this is because she has quite a lot of devices in her body keeping her heart working properly. It makes scanning her heart now very difficult. Had we known, had this technology at the time, we would have done those scans before, and then we could have been able to do this. So I'm actually working with a group at Stanford who have data on someone who had a similar heart to hers physically, but they did do scans prior to them having any devices in there. So with that heart as a reference, we should be able to help her doctor guide her care and hopefully keep her heart in her body as long as possible.
For a very long time.
You heard from Stephen Levine. He's executive director of the Living Heart Project for Dassault Systèmes. The 3D heart model is currently in the testing phase with the FDA. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.